A B C D E F G H I J K L M N O P Q R S T. Hello and welcome once again to PQRST, the Better Late Than Never edition. A couple weeks behind the now every 2 week schedule. I had a bit of a respiratory thing 2 weeks ago. Figured you didn't really want to listen to me rag on a movie and then cough every 5 seconds, so you are welcome. And I am going to get to a movie, and that movie being Armageddon, the Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler, Billy Bob Thornton, Steve Buscemi disaster flick. But before that, just some random thoughts on life. Realized in the past month that I am completely 100% solely responsible for another human being's existence, roughly 70 hours a week. And it's not that that was a big surprise. I've kind of been aware of that for the past 10 months, but it kind of crept up on me how exhausted I was getting. Because we are so blessed. Isaac is not difficult to take care of. He, when he's fed and dry and has had enough sleep, he pretty much kind of watches out for himself. It's not like I leave him in the living room and then, you know, drive off to the store or anything. But he, right now, he's happily playing in his crib in the other room and has been for a good 15 or so minutes, which is why I figured I could try to record a podcast without interruption. But at the same time, even as I'm recording this podcast, part of my attention is on that room, in case he starts crying, in case he might need anything. Even though I know that he is safe in there, even when he's asleep, I guess there are times where I put down responsibility, because I sometimes take naps when he's napping, but there's never a time where I, when I have, you know, sole responsibility for him, if Tiffany's at work or someone else isn't around to lend a hand, there's never a time where I'm completely off duty. So 70 hours a week where I'm on, and there's no coffee breaks per se. And it's not like digging ditches. I'm not putting a lot physically or emotionally into it, and yet 70 hours a week is a lot of work. And it's a lot of work, especially considering that I'm double dipping and putting in 10 to 20 hours a week as a small business person. It's a slow trickle of demand on me physically and mentally and emotionally. And I just hadn't realized how low the tank was getting. The fuel warning light started flashing last week, as it were. I was actually, it was a couple weeks ago now, I was helping somebody move and realized, so for 3 or 4 hours on a Saturday, while my wife was watching Isaac, I had no responsibility as far as child raising. And I was a couple hours into it and realized, you know, I'm working far harder physically than I have in some time, and yet I am so much more relaxed and at ease. Again, cannot stress enough that Isaac is not difficult as a baby. He is very patient with me, but just even though he's a good baby and he makes it pretty easy on me, just knowing that I have to be on and that I have to know where he is and what he's doing, and there's no complete breaks during the day, most of the time, 5 days a week. Basically, I was not doing a very good job taking care of myself, of taking advantage of the times when Tiffany could watch him and I could get a break, or being able to bring, you know, other friends, family into the process. And that's on me. It's not like Tiffany doesn't do a great job taking care of him when she gets the chance to. I was the one who just wasn't doing a great enough job. But I'm watching out for that now. If you hear sounds in the background, that is the cat attacking a bag or something, because she can't stand the fact that I'm not paying attention to her at this time. Now she's going for the drapes, and I might have to stop the recording and kick some little furry cat butt. We'll see. In the meantime, just that's what's going on with William. He's learned that he enjoys talking about himself in the third person, and that he needs to be careful in terms of taking care of himself, because if I don't take care of myself, I get burned out and collapse somewhere. That's not going to be any benefit to Isaac. So just looking out for what is best, trying to stay balanced in life. But cannot state too highly how blessed I am to be primary caregiver for such a fantastic little boy. He is a huge blessing to me and to Tiffany, and he's 10 months old yesterday, and it's election day, which I don't even want to get into. I'm enjoying recording this podcast as a way to not think about the election, or as I sometimes call it, lesser of two evils, 2016, because God is sovereign, and whatever happens today, it's not going to matter all that much 10,000 years from now. And the other thing that's not going to matter all that much 10,000 years from now is the movie Armageddon. Look at that, circling back to the main topic. So, Michael Bay. There are those that think he's fantastic. There are those that think he's not so great as far as a director. I actually looked up a list of the movies that he has made that I've seen, and it's an interesting list. I mean, he made The Rock, directed The Rock, which is a fantastic film, and I'm going to circle back to that in a bit. He's made all the Transformers movies. He made the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, which I rather enjoyed. He made Mystery Men. I like that. He made Coyote Ugly, which is weird as a Michael Bay movie, Coyote Ugly, because as far as I can recall, there were no explosions of any kind. No martial arts sequences. People running around on the top of bars and so forth. But the Michael Bay film. But setting aside Coyote Ugly, in that list, you know, Mystery Men, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Transformers, those are all kind of suspend reality films. With the Transformers, you can, and I have, nitpicked how, in fact, that, I don't remember, but the Transformers movie might be in this list of the top 50 grossing movies of all time, so we might see it on a future podcast. But you just kind of have to go with, okay, these alien beings are robots and they're also vehicles. It's a toy line from Hasbro. You're just going to have to go with it. And, you know, not think too hard about the fact that, okay, when Bumblebee transforms into a car, how is there room for a person to sit in him? How is it that a person can drive him? If you think about it too hard, you're not going to enjoy the films. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I mean, do I have to go into that? I mean, I enjoy the concept. I'm a big fan of that franchise. But if you think too hard about the 6-foot-tall turtles with the mutations and the ninja weapons, you know, the concept breaks down. You don't want to think too hard. Armageddon, though, is based around a physical concept, the idea that a giant meteor is going to strike the Earth and kill us all if we don't do something about it. You know, forgive me if this is going to ruin your day, but there's never going to be a 6-foot-tall talking turtle with ninja skills. There's not going to be an 18-foot robot that can transform itself into a Camaro. Those things are fantasy. But a giant meteor hitting Earth, that could actually happen. I don't believe it's going to myself because, I don't even want to get into what the Bible has to say about the end of the world, but I don't think it's giant meteors that are going to be striking us. I do think that, for those that don't believe in the Bible, it's the sort of thing that could happen, and sort of thing that people, I'm sure there are people on this planet right now who occasionally, if not often, have trouble sleeping for thinking about, oh my gosh, what if a giant meteor is coming? So it's a thing that we actually deal with, and the summer that this movie came out, which would be 1998, there was, as people probably remember, another giant meteor striking the Earth movie, Deep Impact, and neither of the two movies, Deep Impact, Armageddon, neither of the two movies was great. They're both kind of forgettable. Deep Impact, I feel like, has been fairly forgotten. I looked up on Rotten Tomatoes, and critics only gave it a 48, and audiences only gave it a 43, so both of those are failing grades. But it at least treated the subject with some measure of dignity and scientific fact. I mean, they tried to at least acknowledge the laws of physics, which the Michael Bay-directed Armageddon, oh, wait till I get started. So if you're going to watch a asteroid hitting the Earth movie and you want some sense of reality to the experience, watch Deep Impact. If you want to laugh at something ridiculously terrible, by all means, pull up Armageddon. And I said I was going to circle back to The Rock. That's, besides Coyote Ugly, which it's amazing to me that that's a Michael Bay movie. The Rock is Michael Bay explosions and crossed with some real world physics. You know, the taking over of Alcatraz. I don't recall anything in that movie that was just absolutely ridiculous. Okay, that's not true. I recall there were these timed flames in breaking into Alcatraz that, oh, I have to get through this sequence of flamethrowers that, okay, that was ridiculous. But that was just one moment in an entire film. Whereas Armageddon, the stupid starts and it just doesn't stop. And I am not the only one that thinks this. When I pulled up the Rotten Tomatoes thing, here are what some of the critics had to say about Armageddon. Special effects are spectacular, even if the acting and script are patchy. And at 2.5 hours long, it overstays its welcome. How does Armageddon manage to redefine, downward, the standard for summer stupidity? Pomposity knows no limits. Yeah, and this is a very specific quote or statement about how Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer take John F. Kennedy's image for their small town montage at the time when people are hunkering down and waiting for the asteroid to hit. Script plays like a near afterthought, some of the worst dialogue ever, peels your eyelids back and blows your eardrums out until rational analysis is moot. Most of the time, Armageddon simply makes your head hurt. Manola Dargis, LA Weekly. She kind of speaks for me. You're likely to feel, and this is also fun, Matt Sorgel, Florida Times Union. After 2.5 hours of thrills, you're likely to feel more pummeled than entertained. And it goes on like that, so you're welcome to go on Rotten Tomatoes and read what the critics has to say. And if you're wondering at this point what the score was, you might remember, because it was only a minute ago, that Deep Impact got a 48. Armageddon from the critics got a 39, so even more of a failing grade. However, from audiences, a 73. And audiences, well, people like Bruckheimer and Bay are going to keep making films like this if you keep going to see them. But my job at this point on this podcast is to have fun with the genre and this specific movie because I am a nitpicker. And this was number 49 at the time that I wrote the blog that later became the book series of the top 50 grossing movies of all time. So, was I able to find anything to nitpick in Armageddon? Buckle up. First, the recap of the movie, which I failed to do on the last episode with King Kong. If you haven't seen Armageddon in a while, the powers that be discover that there's a giant meteor that's going to hit the Earth and kill us all if nothing is done. The powers that be decide that the only way to deal with this meteor is to drill a hole deep into it and set off a nuclear explosion that will pulverize it at best, or at least separate it into pieces that will bypass the Earth harmlessly. That seems like a reasonable plan. I don't know that I have any big issues with that. And it turns out that the only team in the world that can get this done is a bunch of ragtag misfits, oil drillers led by Bruce Willis, and second lieutenanted by Ben Affleck, and there's a whole, oh my gosh, my daughter is hanging out with this drilling guy story that I don't know I'm even going to get into because it's ridiculous and does not add much, in my opinion, to the movie. They have 14 days, and we'll get into that later, to train these guys, send them into space. There's a whole fueling up at the Russian space station as an excuse for more explosions, and then they have to slingshot around the moon. They have two shuttles. They have to land on the asteroid. There's a machine gun. Oh, did you forget about the machine gun? There's a machine gun. And in the end, Bruce Willis has, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie, why haven't you? It was released like almost 20 years ago. Bruce Willis stays behind while everyone else gets to escape and go back to Earth to blow up the asteroid, and tearful ending and Aerosmith song. So, Armageddon, the nitpicker's guide. The title I gave this one in the book was "Screw the Laws of Physics, Full Speed Ahead." Yeah, so let's get into what I had to talk about. So 1 minute and 10 seconds into the movie, somebody talking, I don't know if it's a voiceover character, I haven't watched it in a while, but somebody's talking about a 6-mile-wide piece of rock that killed the dinosaurs. As far as I know, that's a theory as to what happened to the dinosaurs, but it has not been proven. And two, they know that it was 6 miles wide. Frankly, I like Gary Larson's theory best. I think it was smoking that killed the dinosaurs. The next nit that I wrote down was at 2:43, and this one is not unique to Armageddon. Wide range of movies. As far as I know, only the Firefly universe, the TV show Firefly and then the movie Serenity, has gotten this one right, and kudos to Joss Whedon. There is no sound in space. I know laser blasts are cool, I know explosions are cool, and if you took all the sounds out of the Star Wars and Star Trek and so forth, I probably would miss them, but for the sake of nitpicking, sound does not travel through a vacuum. It doesn't matter how loud it is, it's not going. And, of course, at 2:43 into the movie, there's all this sound going on with the astronauts in space. And, because it's Michael Bay, when the spaceship explodes, we get to see it happen 3 separate times. This one is fun. If you've never nitpicked Armageddon, I encourage you to check this one out. 6.5 minutes into the movie, we are on the streets of New York, and Eddie Griffin... What happened to him, anyway? Is he in cold storage somewhere? I kind of miss him. Eddie Griffin... is playing this kind of shady, selling stuff on the street, a street merchandise guy, and he's got a little dog. And so his dog runs off in one shot to attack this little Godzilla toy. The toy's about as big as the dog. Seller turns around, starts fighting to get his 8-inch toy back. Shot cuts to a close-up of the seller, then back to the fight, and between frames, the 8-inch Godzilla has suddenly become a 6-foot inflatable Godzilla. It went from being a little robot toy about the size of the dog to a 6-foot inflatable Godzilla the size of Eddie Griffin. I mean, it's an enormous continuity error that's like, seriously? Nobody decided that was a bad idea? Okay. But that's okay, because the poor guy is going to be hit by fragments of asteroid in a minute, so I guess his continuity error can be forgiven. 25 minutes into the film, and believe me, I am not sharing all the nits that I found. If you want to really get deep into nitpicking Armageddon, send me an email, videoninja@juno.com. Say, hey, I would like the book that had this movie nitpicked in it, and I would be glad to send it to you, free of charge, because who cares anymore? Have the book. Be delighted to know that someone is even listening to this. 25 minutes into the movie. So the hour the comet was discovered, we found out that we had 18 days to save the Earth. Cut to the oil rig, the only team that can save the planet. The government is asking Harry Stamper to save the day. So just follow me on this one. We discover we've got 18 days to save the Earth. Let's say it took 6 hours to frantically figure out, because we've only got 18 days, oh my gosh, this oil driller, he can do it. 6 hours to find him. When Harry gets to NASA, he refers to 18 hours of travel time. And so that's where I got the 6-hour figure, because that makes 24 hours. We've lost one day. Harry learns of the problem. He looks at the countdown clock, and we have 15 days and 3 hours left. You're telling me it took 2 whole days to get this guy out here and tell him what the problem was? 27 minutes in, Bruce Willis's character, Harry Stamper. I'm only the best because I work with the best. It's my Bruce Willis impression. So this is the scene where Stamper is saying, no, this astronaut team that has been trained for space, they can't do it. You've got to get my ragtag bunch of misfits, and we'll train them to go up into space. This is absolutely ridiculous. We've got, what was previously established? 15 days. We've got 2 weeks to save the Earth. We're going to get these guys that have 0 astronaut training, and we're going to get them ready to go up into space, because obviously in 2 weeks, it's not enough time for me to train the astronauts how to drill a very deep hole. Right off the bat, pretty much, we get the Will Award for this film. I'm gonna move away from Armageddon real quick, because I forgot to mention in the list of Michael Bay movies, Pearl Harbor. recently discovered with Pearl Harbor, and this has nothing to do with Armageddon except that it's a Michael Bay movie, you can skip the first 90 minutes of that movie and then actually get to the war and the interesting parts, and it's watchable. God help you if you're going to watch through the whole entire thing. So, just a little tip from PQRST. Next time you watch Pearl Harbor, skip the first 90 minutes of the 2.5-hour movie. You'll thank me later. Going back to Armageddon, I gave the Will Award to the ridiculousness of having the drill crew go up into space rather than astronauts. Let's see. Oh, and then, so they go and they get the ragtag bunch of misfits. And then we have this hilarious montage of, there's a colonel guy that's upset because the drilling crew has criminal records. Who cares? If they don't get this done, everybody on Earth dies. And then 35 minutes, Bear of the ragtag bunch of misfits says he would like to stay at the White House. They're making a list of things. You know, none of them are ever going to pay taxes again. Give these guys anything they want. If you don't, there is no White House. And so, sure, you can probably move in, Bear. 36 minutes, the doctor's telling Bear that his triglycerides and cholesterol are out of order. Who cares? Besides whatever is physically necessary just to survive liftoff, why are we giving these guys tests? This isn't funny, Michael Bay. It's really not. It's just stupid. They're giving psychiatric evaluations. Again, well, they're crazy. We established that. Who cares? Maybe if you have established that they're crazy, you don't want to give them access to a machine gun? Just a thought. At 38 minutes in, the psychiatric room has a microphone, and one of the drilling guys, who cares which one it is, grabs the microphone and starts singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game or something. No, I guess it's the national anthem. He's the home and the home of the brave. His voice is amplified as though he's singing it at a baseball stadium. Why is the microphone amplified? And furthermore, why is it acting as a microphone, you know, playing it back to where he can hear it in the room? It's just supposed to be recording the stupid psychiatric sessions. 40 minutes in, well, I guess 39 and a half, they reveal the X-71, and Billy Bob Thornton says, "You drillers are the first civilians to ever see this." Hey, pat on the back, pretty good Billy Bob impression. The first civilians to ever see this, so they move it onto the line. It's a gigantic space shuttle. They force all the civilians to turn their backs when they're moving it from the facility where they built it to the launch pad. The reason why I bothered marking this nit is because as I was writing down the nitpicking, I had got a vision of the shuttle with a giant pair of fake glasses and a rubber nose and a mustache hanging off it. Anyway, it was amusing to me at the time. Think about it. It would be amusing to you, too. I'm almost certain. 42 minutes into the film, the ragtag bunch of misfits are shown footage of Neil Armstrong bouncing around on the moon, and they're told the asteroid will be a similar experience. Really? The moon is 10 times bigger than this Texas-sized asteroid. I don't know that the gravity would be 1/10 what it is on the moon's, which is 1/10 of 1/6 of what it is on Earth, and no, I'm not going to do the math. You can do the math. I don't know how much less it would be, but for darn sure, it's not going to be something similar. How do they know this asteroid even has gravity? How do they know anything about this asteroid? Oh, 4239, the lovely Miss Watts, the one of the astronauts that's actually going up with the ragtag group of misfits. Gentlemen, I will give you 30 seconds to put your helmets on. I know it's not a good Miss Watts impression. Get over it. Gentlemen, I will give you 30 seconds to put your helmets on, and the oxygen will be sucked out of this vacuum, and you will know what it's like to be in space. The oxygen will be sucked out of this vacuum, and you will know. So they're standing inside a vacuum cleaner, apparently, or else she was supposed to say the oxygen will be sucked out of this room, and then you'll know what it's like to be in space. You know, I'm just also beyond the fact that, you know, either the script writer or the actress screwed up her line. If there's no vacuum, you'll know what it's like to be in space. I think being in space might involve a little bit more than just not having air to breathe. I've heard there's a temperature issue as well. We'll move on. 46 minutes. AJ, who is the ragtag misfit played by Ben Affleck, and of course, you know, Bruce Willis can't stand him because he and the lovely Liv Tyler have a thing, and Liv Tyler's Bruce Willis's daughter. AJ and Grace are having some special time in this gigantic jet engine exhaust. I guess, you know, it's a movie, you got to make up your mind, all right? Either we're really keeping a close eye on these guys and we're worried about their cholesterol, or we let them do whatever they want, but it can't be both. So, A, it seems like that should be an off-limits place to have romance. And secondly, boy, how romantic inside of a giant jet engine exhaust. But got to be just so clean in there. Maybe it's just me. And then Stamper, the leader of the group of ragtag misfits, is grumping a minute and a half later at 47:30 about how horrible this thing is that Grace and AJ have a relationship. We've got less than 2 weeks or the entire... There's a one in a million shot that this is going to work. Otherwise, the entire Earth is destroyed. Let them have their illicit relationship, Bruce Willis. Come on. The best, you know, likely scenario is that everyone is dead anyway. Does it matter? All right, 53 minutes in. The ragtag bunch of misfits get the night off before the day where they take off on this one in a million mission. And I will buy that they get the night off. Lord knows they deserve it. But I do not buy the premise that any of them are off by themselves. You know, think about what the Secret Service is around for and how important it is to protect the president, to protect, you know, foreign dignitaries, so forth. These guys are the only hope the world has, the entire world has. There is no way that they don't have Secret Service just hanging off of them. This is another thing that Michael Bay will do. He attaches sounds to things that shouldn't have sounds just to make them seem more important and wonderful. So at 59 minutes into the movie, they have this giant countdown clock, light bulbs that change, and we get really way up close to the light bulbs, and there's this bam, bam, there's this thunk, this slamming sound every time the light bulbs change, which must be added by the NASA guys, because if you've ever turned a light bulb on and off, even if you turn on, you know, like 1,000 of them at once, it doesn't make a noise like that. It's just electricity. 1 hour into the movie, the driller astronauts, and I put quotes around that word, are in their orange suits. All the NASA techs have clean room type plastic wear on, and then you have Liv Tyler standing there in a dress and heels. Not that I'm complaining. When last time I saw this movie, I was single, and I was glad she wasn't in, you know, a clean suit, but shouldn't she be? Or are the NASA guys forced to wear clean suits just because? I'm just saying. This is another fun one that you get to see a lot of, that I kept coming back to. Everybody's in the shuttle, and they're starting countdown. There's this really bright light shining through the front windscreen onto the pilot and the people in the cabin. Why is there a really bright light shining through the windscreen onto the people? Okay, I know why there is. It's because we want to see them, much the same way that, you know, people in suits in say, Ocean's 11 or, you know, any stakeout where guys, girls, whoever are in cars. There's always a light on the actors because you want to see them. But I don't deal in, you know, the logic of movies. I deal in reality. And in reality, why are they shining a light in the eyes of a shuttle pilot? Is there a point to this? And nitpickers have a lot of fun with clocks. And there was a lot of chance in the movie Armageddon to have fun with clocks. Usually with a clock, when I get to Back to the Future, now that's going to be a fun one because I love that movie, whereas Armageddon is terrible. It's coming. So if you're patient, you stick with me here, we'll get to do a nitpick of Back to the Future. In Back to the Future, there are times where it's like, this is going to happen in 1 minute, and you start counting, and it takes more than a minute. Or we've only got so many seconds. Usually, with most movies where they do countdowns, things take longer than the time they actually leave, life being what it is. Well, in this case, they actually went the other way. At 107:55, somebody says T-minus 20 seconds. 5 seconds later, 10, 9, 8, so it's like, wait a minute, how did you have 10 seconds in 5 seconds? Then, as they're counting down, 10 down to 0, they get there in 8 seconds instead of 10. But that actually makes sense because they get down to zero and a couple of seconds go by before anything actually happens. Apparently the shuttles were waiting for the right countdown and the person doing the dramatic montage countdown just got it wrong. Fortunately, the shuttles knew what they wanted. 109.17. This one was the runner-up for the Will Award. You'll recall I gave the Will Award to the very idea that these ragtag bunch of morons are going into space. Not to put too fine a point on the subject, but we, as a country, the United States does not have a perfect record when it comes to shuttle launches. A lot of things can go wrong. So, just to make it really dramatic and also much more dangerous than it already has to be, and it's already pretty dangerous, this whole entire operation, they launch the shuttles right the heck next to each other. They launch them basically at the same time, about a football field apart. This is a really, really, really stupid way to get into space. But it is a Michael Bay film. 109.11, as the shuttles take off, there's still a bright light shining through the front windscreen. 110, the shuttles, as shuttles are wont to do, have to throw off, have to disengage. They have to get rid of the external fuel tanks. It takes a lot of fuel to get out of our atmosphere to fight gravity. And then once the tank is empty, you jettison it because you don't want to carry any more weight than you have to. Wow, it's a good thing that we're so close together because the odds that one shuttle jettisoning the fuel tank will hit the other shuttle don't go up with this since they're so close together. 110 and 10 seconds. Both shuttles are now out of Earth's atmosphere. There's still a bright light coming through the windshield. So apparently there's a light on the hood of the shuttle shining into the astronaut's eyes. That's a good idea. 110.48. All right, I will admit, I have never piloted a space shuttle, and you're welcome to take that as gospel. When the pilot says he's going for a retro burn, so I'm reading this as I go, and I just switched the page. This one amuses me. Hopefully you'll find it amusing, too. The pilot says, I'm going for a retro burn. He pushes switches marked PRPLT dump. So he's going for a retro burn, and he pushes a switch marked purplet dump. I leave it to you as to whether or not that would be an accurate thing to do. So they're going to dock the shuttles for more fuel on the Russian space station. And they tell the astronauts, the cosmonaut on board the Russian space station has been up there for 18 months alone. And so we get to have the comedy of seeing the actor, the Russian actor, the cosmonaut, being crazy because he's been up there for 18 months alone. Yeah, I don't buy that the Russians or anybody else would leave a space station in one person's hands for a week, much less 18 months. Oh, this one's fun. Remember earlier where I said screw the laws of physics? 111.04. The shuttles turn in space to line up their approach to the space station. Okay, you can't turn in a vacuum. There's nothing to turn against. That requires wind resistance and air pressure, and they don't have that in space. You can't turn in space. You can rotate if you have nozzles and you spray stuff, it pushes you. Am I getting too technical here? You can't turn in space. 111.30. The crazy cosmonaut says he's ready to fire thrusters anytime, and then he kind of floats away from the window with his hands behind his head. 1 second later, the thrusters fire. So either the Russian space station's thrusters are voice-controlled, or he's operating the controls with his feet. I leave it to you to think about. And we skip some stuff that's like, was I going to write, share anything from this page? I will say that the real, actual astronauts, you know, people from NASA or other space agencies must laugh their heads off at this film. So, yeah, somehow they managed to blow up the space station, which there hadn't been an explosion in a while, so, you know, Michael Bay has a quota he's got to get to. 120.25, they successfully get away from the space station. They're even heavy, one cosmonaut. We even got 90% of their fuel. All right, either the station didn't have a lot of fuel to give them, or those pumps were absolutely amazing, because once we start pumping fuel, there's no break in the action, no, and now we're back, that would allow for the passage of time. They're on the station. The pumps are in operation for maybe a minute, but they still got 90% of their available fuel. those pumps are truly fantastic. Let's see. When the shuttles took off, it was important for everyone's helmet visor to be down and locked, which I can understand because they're shining a light through the windshield into your eyes. Now the crews are preparing to handle 9.5 Gs for 11 minutes as they slingshot around the moon. But everybody's visor's back, they're talking to each other, it's no big deal. Does the visor thing not matter anymore? Especially since the light in the windscreen is still there. Alright, so they slingshot around the moon. The shuttles appear to be maybe a mile above the moon's surface. Frankly, it looks like they're about 100 feet above the moon's surface, but you know, it's hard to tell perspective. They're not, you know, going past the Sears Tower or anything, so we'll say it's a mile. Why do they need to be this close? Can't they be like 10 miles off the moon's surface or 100 miles? What difference does it make to be this close outside of the fact that it looks dramatic and makes this already ridiculous mission that much more ridiculous? And by the way, of course, the shuttles are still wingtip to wingtip. And we haven't even gotten to the most ridiculous part. I've alluded to it a couple times. Did you remember? Are you waiting for it? It gets worse. So they manage to slingshot around the moon. They crash land on the asteroid. So apparently it does have gravity. The shuttle crashes down on a conveniently placed flat spot, and the shuttle stops rather quickly. Nobody's firing reverse thrusters. They've said that it's moving, these are the words of the movie itself, it's moving 500 miles an hour faster than the asteroid, and then it hits ground and it stops in about 300 feet. I don't even have a joke about that. It's just ridiculously stupid. And in the nitpicking at this point, I'm like, I've got an hour still left to go in this movie. Can I go watch something else? Because this isn't fun anymore. Yeah, I hit a point when I was reviewing where it's just like, you know, I'm out of jokes. I'm just going to keep writing down. So there's this, and then there's this. 127:30. Yeah, I haven't mentioned it in a while, so I'll go back to it. The crash landing of the Freedom and the Independence are really loud, considering sound doesn't travel in a vacuum. 131:45. Did I already give out the Will Award? Yes, I did. I'm tempted to make it a tie. Despite the horrendous, dead-stick, 500-mile-an-hour crash that broke the shuttle into pieces, everybody important is alive. No one even has a hangnail. So let's get out the ridiculous armadillo vehicle and go for a joyride. 135 and zeros. This nit isn't really fair, but I'm kind of mad at Michael Bay, so too bad for him. As the guys fiddle around outside of the Independence and marvel how they're not bouncing around like Armstrong did on the moon, yeah, isn't that interesting? It's almost like their gravity is normal. It's like the asteroid has Earth-type gravity, which is weird. Now, I understand that simulating very low gravity, like what they have on the moon or what they should have on the asteroid, would be very expensive. But, well, you've spent enough money on this movie, you think you could have simulated asteroid gravity. Yeah, so this is the point that I was talking about a moment ago. 136:05. Okay, well, this has never happened to me before. My formerly inexhaustible ocean of sarcasm has run completely dry. I had forgotten about this moment when AJ and crew decided to get the armadillo out of the crashed shuttle bay by firing the forward-mounted machine gun. The forward-mounted machine gun that they brought along. Okay, let's start at the beginning. When you're drilling for oil, why would you need a machine gun? You have this vehicle that can... I'm not sure even why oil drillers would have a vehicle that could drive around on the surface of an asteroid, but say for some reason that they do. Why does it have a machine gun, and why does it still have a machine gun in space? This isn't Independence Day. They're not going to be attacked by aliens. And yet, I mean, when you take off to go into space, and you can look this up if you think I'm crazy, this is really true, every pound of weight is accounted for. Read some stuff about really going into space. It is very important that the vehicles that are trying to leave the atmosphere are as light as they can possibly be. But we're not only going to leave this lunar rover, asteroid rover vehicle, we're going to leave the machine gun on the rover. I just am goggled every time I see that scene or think about that scene, that they have a forward-mounted machine gun. Moving on. 138-34. AJ's heavily armed armadillo is rolling through the canyons. Thank goodness there's Earth-type gravity, huh? There's a bright light shining down on them. I don't know from where. And it's remarkable how favorable the terrain is. And, like in the nitpick, like I said, I don't have any sarcasm left. I'm just listing things at this point. 142-30. I guess if it makes sense that the armadillo has an enormous machine gun, it also makes sense that there's a handgun on board the space shuttle Freedom. I'm sure all space shuttles come equipped with a handgun just in case, you know, just in case there's a mutiny. A lot of mutiny in space. Let's see. Oh, okay. This one, I got a second wind in my nitpicking because this one made me happy. 146-28. Misspellings always make me happy. I sense a second wind. Misspellings always make me happy. On the official nuclear briefcase screen, again, it's 146-28 into the movie, the word override, which normally has only two R's, has three. Override. Misspellings in movies make me happy. I mean, they should make me mad because, you know, you're supposed to care about stuff like that, but they make me happy when people miss that. Cycling back just for a second, I think in my nitpicking, somewhere I was like, I don't even know if you could fire a handgun in space. Well, that actually, Mythbusters, the greatest TV show in the history of the world, proved you can. They didn't put a gun into space, but they put a gun into a vacuum, and it fired just fine, thank you. So, don't know why the space shuttle has one, though. Let's see, 147-53. Again with the time nits, and now the nitpicking goes like it's supposed to be. At 147.23, bomb reads 1 minute and 11 seconds. And now one of the ragtag bunch of misfits is looking at the clock, and he looks at the bomb and says, 1 minute? Okay, so let me back up. 147.23, the bomb reads 1.11. 147.53, the bomb should read only about 30 seconds, but the guy looks at it and says, hey, we got a minute left. So either he doesn't know how to read a clock or the bomb's not counting correctly. 148-00. Bruce Willis's character. I've been drilling holes for 30 years and I have never missed a depth that I have aimed for. And that statement makes any sort of sense considering I'm on an asteroid and I've got an hour or so to go 600 feet before the entire Earth is destroyed. This movie is so stupid. Have I established that I think the movie is stupid? 149-16. Oh, yes, the nuclear bomb is going to be set off, and they've got to stop it from going off. They cut the blue wire. The bomb stops at 2 seconds. Now, I'm not expecting you to do the math. I'll do the math for you. That bomb, it took them 1 minute and 55 seconds to count off 1 minute and 11 seconds. Again, almost 2 minutes to count off 1 minute and 11 seconds. That's the sort of time that you get in movies, especially. God bless Michael Bay. All right, so 150-55. You ever hear of Evel Knievel? No, I never saw Star Wars. This isn't a nit, but that's the best joke they could come up with. 151-05. Oh, yes, of course. Cut back to the drilling site. Somebody has planted an American flag. Of course, because they have a forward-mounted machine gun. Of course, they brought an American flag to plant on this asteroid. Is it even legal to do that? Can you plant a flag on an asteroid that you're planning to blow up? Because that means the flag will be incinerated by fire. I think we got to get the legal team on that. 151-45. You got any more bullets in that gun, Sharp? Why is Harry asking if there's more bullets in the gun? This particular gun, they haven't fired any yet. More noise in space. Okay. 152-58. Here's a question. Which is stupider, the bus jump in speed or the armadillo jumping the ravine on the asteroid? Answer, well, as far as nitpicking goes, they both have problems. But with speed, I at least cared whether or not they landed it. Speed is so much a better movie than Armageddon. I mean, in so many ways. I mean, speed is not exactly Remains of the Day, but so much better than Armageddon. All right, 156-14. Yeah, since the armadillo has a machine gun, of course, the drilling crew's equipment would include a remotely aimed auto-fire cannon. Yeah, there's a cannon of sorts that you can remotely aim. And when Steve Buscemi gets the space sickness, because that's a thing, he gets to fire that off and be all crazy. You know, they've got to bring these things along. There might be velociraptors out there. Yes, when Stamper grabs Rockhound to make him stop firing the ridiculous machine gun, they slowly fall to the ground. So, conveniently, gravity sort of shuts itself off when it feels like it. Yeah, space dementia. Is space dementia a thing? Or is Michael Bay just trying to 9-year-old the heck out of this movie? I think we all know the answer to that one. Moving on. 158.36. Earlier, we had a whole lot of thing about, oh, we're going to lose contact with you. We're going to lose contact. Any second now, we're going to lose contact. And they won't be able to speak to him anymore. Well, apparently, despite all that, somebody was just kidding, or they were just trying to make the movie more tense, because at 158.36, they can contact the Earth. And so because there's contact, we cut to a shot of a Midwest town where an air raid siren is going off. Okay, so this whole nit, I don't know, I wrote this one down badly. It wasn't about the fact that we can contact Earth after all. Maybe that's coming up in a second. But the asteroid is going to hit the Earth if these guys don't complete their mission. We only have a few minutes left. Kiss your butt goodbye. There's an air raid siren going off, and a family goes to hide in the cellar. Is there really a stop, drop, and roll procedure for the end of all life on the planet? You know, does it make a difference if you're hiding in the cellar or, you know, throwing a frisbee in the park? The Earth's going to be destroyed. Pretty much just, you know, find something fun to do for the last minute. Play Nintendo, you know, whatever. Actually, it's interesting to think about what humanity would do if we knew that there was an inevitable global killer on the way. You know, if you knew that 24 hours from now the Earth is going to be destroyed, there's nothing we can do about it, kiss your butt goodbye, what would you do for that last day? You know, I think of the quote by somebody famous that if I knew I would die tomorrow, today I would plant a tree. But if the Earth is going to be destroyed tomorrow, planting a tree today, probably not too valuable. As far as, you know, things that people have some control over, like radio broadcast, TV broadcast, I would expect some of the best speeches, the best writing the world has ever seen would be played for all to hear. I mean, Pauly Shore's Biodome, they would air that at least twice. Moving on. Oh, let's see. So, time is of the essence. This has never been more true than when every second counts to try to save, you know, 7 or so billion people's lives. Time is incredibly crucial, and yet, at 2:07:55, Sharp discovers that the bomb's remote detonator won't work. Stamper asks, how do we detonate it? Sharp looks around, not answering the questions, for 5 seconds before the shot cuts away. Look, we don't have time to be dramatic. Let's make with the snappy answers already. 2:08:20, they've told us that there's a zero barrier. It's the moment where, after this second passes, it is too late to save the Earth. Nothing you can do will make a difference. Even if you detonate the bomb, the Earth is still going to be destroyed. So the sooner the better, as far as detonations are concerned. In the NASA control room, Billy Bob says there's only 18 minutes left to decide who stays behind, because somebody has to detonate the bomb. They can't trigger it remotely. Somebody has to stay. We cut back to the shuttle bay. Everybody's gathered to draw straws, basically. Seriously, nobody has the stones to volunteer on-site to save the world. I mean, if nobody does and you take too long with this, everyone dies anyway. These guys are some real men here. So there's the whole thing where AJ draws the short straw, and then Bruce Willis's character trips him up or whatever so that he can stay back, and, oh, it's the self-sacrifice thing. It just takes forever. 2:12:10. I cannot emphasize enough how every second counts. And yet, Bruce Willis's character takes a moment to look around at the surface of the asteroid. He wants one last look at the lovely view. He stops for a farewell moment with his daughter. Yeah, it's a beautiful moment, you know, that he gets to talk to his daughter over the video phone, even though I thought they had lost contact like 20 minutes earlier. But seriously, your daughter, along with everyone else on the planet, is dead if you don't set this bomb off. Why don't you speed up already? Yes, in an homage to Star Wars, 2:16:35, the crazy cosmonaut fixes the problem with the shuttle by bashing a wrench against the panel. And I submit that this has never actually fixed anything in the history of the world, but it is a Michael Bay movie. 2:16:59. In case you missed it, because I know I had, the light is shining through the windscreen into the pilot's eyes again. And the takeoff is loud, even though there's no sound in space. And the shuttle turns as it leaves the asteroid, because screw the laws of physics, it's a Michael Bay movie. More time nits, 2:18:09. There was 1 minute left, and it's been... They said 1 minute left, and then 27 seconds pass, and oh, okay, but we still have 44 seconds. And then the clock makes up for lost time. In 6 seconds, it goes from 44 seconds remaining to only 20. NASA needs to learn how to make a clock. Or maybe Michael Bay's editors need to learn how time works. 2:18:33, the countdown clock reaches 2 seconds. So at 2:17:42, there was only 1 minute left, and that minute passed in 51 seconds. Does time just function differently in the NASA world? Now, the asteroid detonates, and everybody celebrates, and there's... I feel like Independence Day did this, too. I won't say a lot of films. I think it's a thing that we just don't really think about. Wherever you are right now, where I am right this second, it is 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sun is shining. If I could suddenly be in, say, Thailand, where it's roughly somewhere between 2 and 4 in the morning, the sun would not be shining. If I was in Australia right now, I'm pretty sure the sun would not be shining. The sun is not out everywhere all the time, of course. And yet, at 2:19:19, we see shots from around the world of the asteroid detonating, and you can't see it detonating everywhere because there's a whole line of sight issue. If I could look up into the sky and see something, I'm sorry, people in Thailand could not look up into the sky and see the same thing. It's also 3 o'clock in the afternoon everywhere on the Earth, which is a good trick. 2:19:37, if you want to bother, this is kind of fun to see. The NASA control room is full of very happy people because they're not going to die, except for this one guy in the corner who's just kind of standing there. There was one extra who just wasn't paying attention or had been barked at by the director one too many times or something, because everybody's cheering except this one guy in the corner who's like, yeah, but I wanted a sandwich. All right, one more. 2:21:13. This is why I love nitpicking movies, especially bad movies. 2:21:13. When the shuttle, some time ago, before, you know, the jumping the ravine and the machine gun and the space dementia, landed on the asteroid, there were very clearly skids coming out of the bottom of the shuttle so that it could land on the asteroid. Now the shuttle is coming down at the Kennedy Space Center, and there are wheels coming out so the shuttle can land at the Kennedy Space Center. That's really, really fantastic shuttle design, I must say. Oh, man. And so 2 hours and 21 minutes later, we hit credits, and the ridiculous movie is over. Seriously, if you need a bad movie for bad movie night where people gather together and make fun of something terrible, I highly recommend Armageddon because there's so much to work with. And if you're out there and you love the movie Armageddon, well, I hope you still love it after hearing that. Now then, the next time I do a nitpicking podcast, we actually get to not only nitpick the 48th movie out of the top 50, we get to do a good movie, that being Night at the Museum, which I thoroughly enjoyed and yet found stuff, even as I enjoy it, to nitpick. So we'll come back to that here hopefully in a couple of weeks, assuming that the result of the 2016 election is not the end of all life on the planet. Maybe we send Harry Stamper out with a machine gun. Meanwhile, I hope you are owning your stage and that... Now I was going to try to quote the Aerosmith movie, but I don't want to miss a thing. I can't really work that in. Darn! I'll come back later when I have a good ending. But in the meantime, own your stage, and we'll see you for Night at the Museum here in a little bit.